Welcome to Golau, where we shed some light on politics, policy and polling in Wales and the world. In this special episode, we've invited Martin Shipton, chief reporter for the Western Mail, to discuss his new book, Political Chameleon, with Professor Richard Wynne-Jones of the Wales Governance Centre. Before we start the interview, here's just a little taster from Gwynoro Jones, who also wrote the foreword to Martin's book.
He was a one-off. I have no hatred towards George, right? But he was not a trustworthy person. The George who could be very friendly, very cooperative, full of life. But later on, I started to see the other side because he had a chip on his shoulder that about half a dozen of us, what he used to refer to often as the crypto-nationalists. But it wasn't just us Welsh group. There was no love lost between George and Callaghan. Two Cardiff MPs, when George later on in life became ill, I think, with throat cancer or something, and he bumped into Callaghan, and he put his hand forward to Jim, and Jim never returned the hand. George said, "Oh, Jim, come on," and he said, and Callaghan told him, "George," he said, "it's not how long we live, but how we've lived our lives." One of the most dangerous politicians Wales have ever produced. And I'm sorry to say that, but it is true.
Martin, congratulations, first of all. I really genuinely enjoyed this book. It's full of those little details that, you know, make these kinds of things fascinating. So, for example, I didn't know that Jomo Kenyatta lived in Cardiff and loved a Welsh kick.
I know, it is remarkable, isn't it? Yes, these things.
Yeah. One learns so much, about Wales, about Welsh politics through this book. But in a sense, it's an unlikely book to have... I mean, why did you decide to devote clearly a great deal of time to a public figure, George Thomas, who, you know, who's been dead almost very nearly 20 years, whose star has faded quite dramatically, I think, in that period? I mean, why did you do this and inflict this upon yourself?
I think the thing is, Richard, and thank you very much for your kind words, by the way, that he does represent a strand of Welsh culture and consciousness, if you like, that does persist to this day. One of the early chapters in the book is called The Servile Welshman, and he epitomised the servile Welshman to a T. As many people will know, he became extremely sycophantic to the royal family. He hated devolution. He hated the Welsh language. And there is an element, isn't there, within Wales of people who take that stance. Even to this day, we will see on social media people having a go at the Welsh language.
And on the BBC, in fact.
And indeed on the BBC, although sometimes that's done from outside Wales. But nevertheless, there are people within Wales who are prepared to buy into that narrative. And that's quite a strange phenomenon, and one wonders why that happens. So I thought that I'd take a look at this man who represents that not honourable tradition, and take a sort of complete look at him and see what his influences were and how he actually conducted himself over the years.
There's so much to talk about here, because one of the characteristics of the book is that it is even though I think your feelings are pretty clear about the object of the book or the subject of the book, there's a genuine attempt to be fair-minded and to discuss some of his achievements, as well as some of the problems that crystallise around him. So let's just start with just the broad brush for those people who may be, especially, you know, younger listeners who might not know that much about him. We have this incredible trajectory of a person from an extremely poor background, at least in periods, to hobnobbing with great delight with royalty and some very, very rich people. But also politically, this journey from the Bevanite left to what appears to be very right-wing Euroscepticism by the end of his life.
Well, very much so. And in fact, one could say that he's even to the left of the Bevanite left, because there was a period in the late 40s when he got involved with a group of Labour MPs who were led by a man called Connie Zeliakis, who I discovered from the correspondence which exists in the National Library archive, was effectively controlled by the Soviet embassy. And so you have a situation where you've got George Thomas, who many people in Wales, if they think about him at all, would just see him as some royal sycophant and the sort of guy who gives you the creeps, actually. Nevertheless, in his early political career, he was involved with a group of hard left communists. He actually met Stalin. He was flown down to meet Stalin when he was on a trip touring around Russia and Eastern European satellite states. So you have him doing that. But then he obviously thinks that this isn't going to profit him. He was given warnings by some of his senior colleagues that it was not doing his career any good to be hobnobbing with such people. Nevertheless, it's quite interesting that while he clearly went through his papers quite assiduously and decided what he wanted to keep and what he didn't want to keep, he usually didn't want to keep anything which was negative relating to him. He actually held on to a lot of this communist material, which is there to be seen in the archive today. And then, of course, we see his trajectory. He became what was described as the ear, nose and throat. Yeah. ENT became one of his nicknames to Labour MPs, because he was seen as a bit of a spy for Harold Wilson.
Can we go? I mean, we come back to the whole Wilson relationship in a moment, but just this period, which I found fascinating, and I was aware that he'd been, obviously there was this. He was an international celebrity for a moment back in the mid-40s when he ended up in the middle of the Greek Civil War.
He was,
ended up disappearing in very mysterious circumstances, and ending up with the communist guerrillas for a period. And then, of course, as I wasn't aware that after that, you know, he was touring with the kind of... he was touring Poland and Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union and playing footsie with the Stalinists, essentially.
Yes. Yeah.
One of the things that one of the questions which, you know, one has heard discussed in pubs around political Wales is, you know, to what extent that he was compromised in that period, because you do have this very strange move from crypto-communism. And he kind of moves right steadily, and he stops being prominent on the left and supporting those very, very kind of, well, the Stalinist cause. Is there any evidence at all that he was kind of compromised in that period, or do we have to wait for archives to be opened? You know, this isn't in the National Library in Aberystwyth,
well,
presumably.
Now, what we do know for sure is that, but it's certainly the case, for example, that... he was involved in the early days with what became CND, although he didn't actually join it. It was all a bit peculiar. He was actually on the march, which was seen by the historians of CND as the start of it, but he didn't actually join it. And so one wonders what has gone on in the background. You often find this, actually. You think, what has gone on in the background to make him change his stance? Now, there are those who would argue that he was simply a self-seeking person. I mean, I've called him in the title of the book Political Chameleon. Yeah. And he certainly changed very greatly in his stances over the years. But the motivation for that, I mean, some people like Gwenora Jones, for example, would simply say that it was wholly self-interested, that he wanted to further himself. And if he found that he was going in a certain direction, then it wasn't in his interest to do so, he would change course. But of course, given his homosexuality and the fact that it was illegal, one would have to think that there would be a possibility of having been compromised at some stage.
I mean, he was obviously I mean, I think one of the problems with the thesis that he was wholly self-interested, that there were some passions in his life, both loves and hates, which seemed to have transcended everything. I mean, the two characters who were, in a sense, the great loves of his life, I think, except for himself, which might have been the primary love, but his mam. So his mother is a major character in the book. And, you know, what I wasn't aware, for example, the fact that she used to have a message, a personal message on his election addresses. I think this is one from the mid-50s. "My son George is known to you all. No one knows better than I do the care and the anxiety with which he fights for those who seek help. He brings his Christian faith to his public work. His entire life is given in service to other people. He's a man of principle. I urge you to vote for him because I know he will never let you down." So, ma'am.
It was very, very influential. And, of course, that goes back to his childhood, as it inevitably would. And they had a very troubled childhood, because what happened was that his father, who was actually a Welsh speaker from Carmarthenshire, had moved over to the valleys in order to take work in the mines. He was quite a brutal man. And he ended up going to the First World War. But when he went over eastwards, he got involved with a woman in Kent. And there was some very unfortunate incident where he actually tried to reassign the military pay that he'd been getting from his family in South Wales to this woman in Kent. So I strongly believe that George Thomas's antipathy to the Welsh language stemmed from that. He associated his father as a Welsh speaker from Carmarthenshire with acting in a dishonourable way in this way, and then he just developed a hatred of the Welsh language. But I mean, certainly so far as his mam was concerned, she was the one who nurtured him. He absolutely idolised her. In the correspondence that he was getting from other people across the range, they would always be asking after mam, and then of course. When Gwenola Jones used to go round on a Sunday evening to get a briefing.
Yeah, there's a particularly icky story about there, which I think you should share with us. Because that was a moment where I was holding the book at arm's length.
Well, what happened was, Gwenola Jones, who at the time was effectively the press officer for what became Welsh Labour, what is known as Welsh Labour now, used to go around on a Sunday evening to get a briefing from George about what the government was doing. This is when he was Secretary of State for Wales. And they would be in the parlour of George's bungalow in King George V Drive in Cardiff, where on either side of the mantelpiece there were huge photographs of the Queen and Prince Charles.
Obviously. Don't we all?
Indeed. Yes. And George would keep his papers in a side room. In order to get to the side room, he would have to pass his mam. And apparently what he used to do was, as he was going past her, he would say, "Mam," and then lean forward and kiss her, go into the side room, get the document, come back and say, "Mam," again, and kiss his mam again, and then sit down. And Gwenola Jones, I think, found this quite astonishing. And he, at the time, had a good working relationship with George Thomas, but I think he found that creepy at the time. But then later, of course, he, in the House of Commons, found him to be completely nauseating, and he developed a very serious antipathy towards him.
Yeah, which comes out in the book. We'll come back to the hatreds. He clearly nurtured his hatreds very carefully. But the other great love, in a sense, I'm not sure if this is appropriate, is Julian Hodge, who is, again, a really important character in the book, a really important character in 20th century Welsh life, who, again, is, I think, largely forgotten. So tell us a little bit about the relationship with Hodge. Who was he, and why was that so important to George Thomas?
Well, I found this very strange, actually. There's a lot of material in the archive, which is correspondence between Julian and George. Julian Hodge was a very wealthy businessman who actually was born in London, but he was brought up in Gwent. And one of the businesses that he had was basically lending money to people, very much like a sort of subprime mortgage arrangement, which, as we know, caused such catastrophe a few years ago. But what he was doing was lending money at high rates of interest to people. He wanted to develop a Bank of Wales. And he purported to be a Welsh patriot and said that it was necessary to create a financial sector in Wales that had its own bank. He tried to get it registered as the Bank of Wales and met a lot of opposition because perhaps not unnaturally, the authorities in London thought that calling it the Bank of Wales would give it the impression that it was some sort of state institution when it was obviously just a private venture. So he saw himself as a man who was greatly wronged by the establishment. And George developed a very deep friendship with him. And I was really quite astonished at the depth of that friendship, because there are letters in the archive where they are exchanging messages of love to each other. We know that they went on holiday on a number of occasions together to Paphos in Cyprus. They also, very strangely, were friends with Sheikh Yamani, the Saudi oil minister, and they had some kind of spiritual experience with him in the Arabian desert. And I think that what they shared was a superficial veneer of religiosity which would justify all of their actions. And they certainly used to butter each other up. They were both men of great egos. I'm told that, and I've heard this both from family sources of Julian Hodge, but also from people who were MPs at the time, who were aware of not at the depth of their relationship, but certainly aware of their friendship. They used to telephone each other every day at an allotted time, and they would have these conversations. And clearly, they were both dependent on each other. Later on, Julian Hodge became something of an ideologue who was anti-EU. He was certainly very much against the establishment of an assembly as well. And they nurtured each other, if you like. They fed off each other, and it went right the way through to the end of George's life when, in the last months of his life, he became a supporter of the precursor to UKIP, Jimmy Goldsmith's referendum party.
George Thomas wore his religiosity very openly and publicly and would have regarded it as a central core element of who he was. And I just quoted his mum's note to his, you know, he brings his Christian faith to his public work. You seem to be rather cynical about his religious, the seriousness of his religious beliefs. Is that right?
Yes, we do know that at the time when he, over many years, was uttering this kind of religious-inspired statements, and of course he was very much involved in the campaign to keep the Sabbath. He was totally against opening pubs on a Sunday because he regarded that as effectively the devil's work.
And prayer meetings in the breakfast prayer meetings in the speaker's house and all of that sort of stuff.
But at the same time, we know that he was engaged in furtive homosexual activity, which on occasions certainly strayed into the realm of criminality, because there were a number of complaints which were made. And since it became public knowledge that this book was being published, there are more people who've come forward to say that either they or people they knew were effectively indecently assaulted by George. So we've got this situation where the man is pretending to be a pillar of rectitude, where he is behaving as if religion totally inspires his life and everything that he does in it, whereas there is this this furtive element which he couldn't possibly admit to, even after the decriminalization of homosexuality. He wasn't able to admit that he was gay. And part of that will probably relate to the fact that he had a particular interest in young men. And we're talking about a period when, for quite a few years after the decriminalisation, the age of consent for homosexuality was 21. Yeah. So he could have come stuck with that. And then, of course, the darkest thing which overhangs him is this allegation that he raped a 9-year-old boy round about the time, if you work out the dates, when he was a member of the British cabinet. So, you know, that is very disturbing. I mean, clearly the police have decided that they can't take that forward, and that's hardly a surprise, really, given that he's been dead for 20 years. He's not available to be interviewed. But the complainant has been in touch, I know, with people, and is you know, there doesn't seem to be any reason why a false allegation would be made. But obviously, we can't definitively say that happened, because it hasn't been tested in court. But clearly, there were, from his own perspective, from George Thomas's own perspective within the Methodist Church, homosexuality was seen as a sin, and he couldn't possibly acknowledge it. And yet, he was presenting himself as a complete pillar of rectitude. So there is that conflict there.
The chapter where you discuss his sexual proclivities and the allegations, I think is clearly very carefully written and very thoughtfully conceived. It always strikes me, I don't know your views, but it always strikes me when I go into City Hall, there is a very, very large portrait of George Thomas on the wall. And I mean, I'm kind of interested in your views, is should that portrait be hanging in City Hall?
Well, I have just yesterday actually was talking to people about this, not in relation to George Thomas, but in relation to Sir Thomas Picton, another great figure from Welsh history, who had some extremely discreditable elements of his life. If it were demonstrated that George Thomas had raped a 9-year-old, I mean, of course, we already can be fairly confident that he was indecently assaulting young men. I think there is a case, because we're not talking here about someone from many years ago who was engaging in activity that would at the time have been seen as normal and maybe appropriate. We are talking about somebody who acted in a criminal way. And I think already, of course, we've seen some distancing from the George Thomas name. The hospice movement has decided to relinquish his name. The pub, Tonopandy, has changed its name. That was perhaps more to do with the Abervan business, where he acted very dishonourably there by wanting to grab £150,000 out of the fund that was set up for the relatives in order to remove the tip. And of course, that came to renewed light last October at the time of the 50th anniversary.
That in particular is a very, very powerful chapter. The image of the children's faces being washed so that the bodies can be identified as, you know, it's one of those moments where, it's a very, very powerful chapter. And his behaviour in colluding, and actually promoting a situation where money was taken out of from the gifts given to the people of Aberfan to clear the tip. It's just an extraordinary story, isn't it?
And it's absolutely shocking.
And credit to people like Ian McLean, our academic colleague, who've spent years digging this stuff out.
Indeed. And another element of this, which I found quite shocking, was in his own autobiography, he tells how on the day he went to a home of a bereaved parents where obviously they were waiting for their child to come back. The child didn't come back. He was there with Lord Snowdon, and he was more interested in telling the bereaved parents how lucky they were to have a cup of tea made for them by a member of the royal family than he was in offering genuine sympathy and support for people who'd lost their child. And I found that quite shocking.
It's very difficult to mount a case in the defence of George Thomas. But let me try. Let's start with that, because, you know, one of the things which is striking is that as the cabinet minister, he spent weeks in Aberfan after the tragedy with families, and what must have been, you know, unimaginably difficult circumstances. He clearly had an ability to empathise with people. I mean, there's David Wigley, who's got, you know, more reason than most to be negative about George Thomas, given their diametrically opposed views, talks about the genuine sympathy that George Thomas showed to David Wigley and his wife when their two sons tragically died. There are lots of stories of a person who could express genuine human sympathy and make people, he had that ability.
Well, he did. And also, another thing that surprised me greatly was the sheer volume of cards that were sent to him on his birthday from across Wales and further afield when he was ill, and in his last years he had several bouts of cancer. There would be literally hundreds and hundreds of messages that were sent to him, and people would send him greetings cards, and he clearly inspired a lot of warmth from people, particularly from the older generation, of course. And maybe his folksiness appealed to people. It's also true, and I'm not wishing to disagree with you at all about the fact that he was able to show empathy to people in tragic circumstances, but it's also true that he craved the affection of people. And in the same way that he showed sycophancy towards the royal family, he had a lot of people who were sycophantic towards him, and he certainly relished that. Yeah. And therefore, I think to him, in the aftermath of the Aberfan tragedy, it would have appeared to him the absolutely right thing to do for him to go and be seen in the community where it had happened. But I think he was also getting out of that some vicarious justification for himself as the important man who was coming on the scene. But of course, many people who were there would have seen it as a good example of a powerful person coming to show empathy to them.
The other thing which I'd forgotten, actually, or needed to be reminded of in terms of his achievements, was leasehold reform. I mean, there, in terms of policy, I mean, you can argue that he was a pretty... Well, I mean, the Aberfan thing completely clouds everything about his period as Secretary of State. But in terms of leasehold reform, which was his big kind of cause as a backbencher, that was something which had a profound effect here in Cardiff and in South Wales more generally. And I think that is an achievement in terms of
I think
his.
It is, yes, most definitely. That's the most obvious achievement that he had, and it was something that he plugged away at for many years, actually. He was very keen from his early days in Parliament, and he was, of course, elected in 1945 to see some leasehold reform, because what was happening then was that people living, as you say, both in Cardiff and in the valleys were often living in homes which had, say, 99-year leases. And these were often quite humble homes where there would be no indoor toilets, certainly nothing like central heating. It would all be quite Spartan. But these people would be paying rent. Effectively, they would own the leasehold, but they wouldn't own the freehold. So when the freehold was up, they would find themselves having to pay quite a considerable amount of money at the time in order to be able to stay in their homes. And there were unscrupulous landlords who were very keen to have them turfed out of these homes. And that's what happened a lot. So He does have to be given credit for having plugged away at that for such a long time, although it did take longer than one might have hoped for. I mean, one might have thought that the reforming 1945 to 51 Attlee government would have done something about it, but they were obviously more interested in the bigger picture in terms of setting up the NHS, etc. But I mean, certainly that is something which he was passionate about. It also comes across, I think, that he did have an enormous sympathy for people in Africa, because he tells the fact that he was on good terms with African presidents, some of whom were obviously corrupt. But nevertheless, he'd known them in the early days when they were fighting against British colonialism, etc. And he was highly regarded. He tells a couple of anecdotes about how he managed to cool things down between the UK government and the former colonies. So that's another good thing in his favour. But I mean, overall, I think the picture is quite a negative one.
Well, one of the things which has struck me from talking to people in the Labour Party over the years, especially the older generation who knew him, is that very, very, very few people have a good word to say about him. And certainly on the devolutionist wing of the Labour Party, it's clear that he loathed them and they loathed him equally passionately in return. So, I mean, he was a man who nurtured his hatred and devoted a lot of time to, you know, I didn't realise, for example, that he and Jim Callaghan clearly had a very difficult relationship.
They did. That actually went all the way back to the time when they were selecting candidates back in 1945, and George fancied his chances in what became Cardiff South, and he went for selection, but he was actually beaten by Jim Callaghan, who at the time had no connection with Cardiff at all, but he was in the Navy, and he came along in his naval uniform and obviously wowed the local members of the party, whereas George was perhaps, you know, rather ungainly character from the valleys with a bit of a squeaky voice, didn't go down as well as Jim Callaghan.
And I think and stayed out of the war in very mysterious circumstances.
Very mysterious circumstances. He has one line devoted in his autobiography to the fact that he was supposedly granted a medical exemption from serving in the armed forces in the war. Now, I have tried through Freedom of Information requests to get access to the records, the military records, which would show, on what grounds he was excluded. Because the bizarre thing is that in this one sentence in his autobiography, he says he managed to get an exemption, but he doesn't actually say what was wrong with him. Yeah. So that's immediately suspicious. And any attempt to find out whether there is a record of him in the medical records, because medical records were kept of all these tribunals that took place, which granted people exemptions. But in fact, they're not due to be released until about 2024. But when I did the FOI requests, what they came back, what the National Archives came back and said to me was that there was no record of anyone of his name in the relevant documentation. Now, it has been suggested to me that strings were pulled to stop him having to go to war. And he was very prominent in the National Union of Teachers. And it was actually suggested to me that there may have been some monkey business that went on where influence was brought to bear so that he didn't have to go to war. I mean, clearly, there's no definitive evidence of that, but it's certainly very suspicious that there is no documentation.
It's a very strange story. But that relationship with Callaghan clearly never recovered on George's side, at least in terms of that, and being snubbed by the good people of the Labour Selection Committee in what became Cardiff South was that relationship never recovered.
And he did of course become the MP for the neighbouring constituency, and they would travel up on the train together. But many years later, when his autobiography was published in the mid 80s, Jim Callaghan read it, and he was absolutely devastated. I mean, when I interviewed David Wheatley, he told me that Jim Callaghan had just found out what George had said about him, the snide comments that he'd made about him in his book. And he said, I've known him for all these years and I never once thought that he thought that of me. And Jim Callaghan was personally very hurt by that.
I mean, there was deep, deep mutual... I mean, obviously, he'd George Thomas regarded what he called the crypto-nationalists in his own party with deep contempt and suspicion. And so people like Cledwyn Hughes and et cetera, Tom Ellis, all these people were regarded as you know, being enemies in a sense. But clearly, the animosity was public between him and Welsh nationalist supporters outside the Labour. And that was mutual animosity in the sense that he and his mother were targeted by some of the fringes of the nationalist movement. That comes out in the book, and yes. Obviously that was very difficult.
This was round about the time of the investiture where George Thomas actually took on a project that had been begun by Cledwyn Hughes, and obviously there had been discussion which had taken place behind the scenes about whether there should be an investiture of a Prince of Wales. It had been done before, and a decision was taken to do it. But then the way that it was done was very ostentatious and obviously antagonised a lot of people on the nationalist wing of political movements in Wales. And on the fringes, there were death threats issued to George and his mam. I think she was taking telephone calls in the middle of the night with people screaming abuse. And clearly, he played on that. And there's a lot of correspondence that he got, because he made this sort of thing public, and there was a lot of correspondence that he got from sympathisers whose hatred of anything to do with Welsh nationalism and the idea of a Welsh national movement became manifest. And I certainly think that he did use that. But, I mean, clearly one would in no circumstances condone the sort of abuse that he was subjected to, but he certainly did use it to his benefit in his anti-nationalist narrative.
It did, but I mean, it's an important element of the story that, you know, tends to be written out. So again, it's important that it's here. But one of the things I find interesting about the if you like, the Gwynorod Jones thesis, which is essentially that he was a total chancer who had no core beliefs at all and would say anything to further his own career, is that it appears that his extreme anti-nationalism, if you like, actually undermined his chance of becoming a cabinet minister in this when Labour was re-elected in 1974. It's very clear, and indeed Gwynorod Jones takes great delight in telling you that, you know, they wielded the knife and made sure that Wilson was aware that the losses that they'd suffered in Welsh-speaking Wales were down to George Thomas's hostility to all things Welsh language and Welsh related. So there's a kind of interesting paradox there that, you know, he did actually have a core belief, which was being deeply hostile to that, which actually then undermined his chances of being in Wilson's government post 74.
Well, that's absolutely right. And of course, he had been the shadow secretary of state, and he thought that he was going to be a shoo-in. And indeed, you know, even down to getting the telephone call saying, come and see me or come and see the prime minister, the incoming prime minister, he thought that he was going to be made secretary of state for Wales. And he was told that he could be the chairman of Ways and Means, which is basically deputy speaker.
But of course, this is where, you know, it's snatching victory from the jaws of defeat. That then gives him the opportunity to become speaker, which is clearly, you know, the best thing that ever happens. It makes him ultimately a global celebrity of a kind. And I was wondering, in terms of his role as speaker, I mean, the book is very interesting on the way that he was meant to be even-handed, but he was even-handed on a particular side, and he was clearly sycophantic towards Margaret Thatcher. Labour thought that he was particularly difficult to them in that admittedly difficult period where Labour was trying to run a minority government. So it's very interesting on the detail of all of that. But I was wondering if you kind of open the lens a little bit in terms of making the broader public more aware of how Parliament worked, you know, making it not inclusive might not be the right word, but at least more visible. He did play a reforming role in a way there?
Well, in fact, he, of course, was the speaker at the time when it was broadcast for the first time. Not televised, but on radio. And this is where he became so well known for his order. I won't try to imitate him too well. I'm not a very good mimic. But, this order became known throughout the world, and it did create him as a big celebrity. He loved all of the pageantry that went with being speaker. He loved the dressing up. He loved being able to hobnob with members of the royal family. He loved using Speaker's House as a location where he could bring important people. And he also, of course, as you've suggested, Richard, used his office as the speaker to favour the Conservatives. And he was actually taking advice from a backbench Conservative MP on constitutional issues and then implementing that advice. There are a number of nauseating letters that he wrote to Margaret Thatcher where he is really grovelling to her. And, of course, he used to try to make out that he was defending the office of the Speaker, which, as we know, was extremely important at the time of the start of the Civil War in England back in the 17th century, where the role of the Speaker was crucial in defending Parliament. It wasn't parliamentary democracy, but it was Parliament against the monarchy. And so he saw himself in that long tradition. And yet, at the same time as he was doing that, publicly and asserting that he was the upholder of these principles, he was actually showing enormous sycophancy to Margaret Thatcher. He was fixing things so that Labour was frustrated with legislation that it wanted to bring in. And also, so far as devolution was concerned, he was involved effectively in a conspiracy with Leo Absey for an amendment to be put. He accepted an amendment that was put, which insisted on there being a referendum before 1979, because originally the intention was to have a Welsh Assembly and a Scottish Parliament without a referendum. But it was George Thomas who, at the behest of Leo Absey, allowed, in circumstances which would not normally have been permitted, an amendment to be put forward. It was called a reasoned amendment, which meant that the referendum would happen. So he succeeded in stopping devolution for 20 years.
And of course, and one of the great ironies of his final days is that he died, was it 4 days after the referendum on the 18th of September? So he died 4 days later. So and he was compos mentis and was aware of what had happened. And his final political intervention was to urge a no vote. He and Julian Hodge, I think, funded the no campaign, and he lived to see.
He did, and we know from one of George's friends, Patrick Cormack, now in the House of Lords, who was a Tory MP at the time, we know that effectively it was the final straw for him. I mean, he was dying of cancer, but news that the Assembly was going to exist was the final straw for him, and he gave up the will to live and died.
There's a great phrase, or striking phrase rather, that George Thomas uses. He refers to the idea of racial parliaments in Wales, Scotland, and England. I mean, that was an extraordinary.
Extraordinary. Well, he wanted to deny everything Welsh. He wanted to deny everything Scottish. He just thought that Britain was the country, and that people who wanted to have any kind of self-government or self-determination for Wales were beyond the pale. I mean, I know that I mean, I tell the story, don't I, in the book about how he did have a habit of offering patronage to young men in particular. Sometimes he would get them jobs, and sometimes he would just sort of offer them avuncular advice. But there was a case where he was actually through a family connection. He knew a particular young person. That person was called John Osmond, who later became, as we all know, the director of the Institute of Welsh Affairs. And he was on quite friendly terms with George for a period until George discovered that John was very much in favour of devolution. And at that point, he just cut him out entirely.
What finally is the legacy of George Thomas in contemporary Wales? It's striking that there was a what seems to be an extraordinarily ill-conceived idea that they would have a museum in his bungalow on George V Avenue.
Absolutely bizarre.
Which came to nothing. You mentioned that the book starts with, you know, looking for traces of George Thomas in Tonopandy, of which there are, you know, I don't want to give away too much, but there are very few. His name is being erased. His post, you know, there's still a big portrait of him in City Hall, but it's a seldom trod corridor, I suspect. I mean, what's left of George Thomas in Wales of 2017?
I think it's not so much what is left of him as a person. It's more of the ideas that he represented. And the ideas that he represented was that Wales did not deserve to have any kind of autonomy at all. He was very much against the European Union. So his legacy, to a degree, has become Brexit. And he would no doubt see himself as posthumously vindicated in that respect. He was delivering speeches even when he got cancer, which was very much against the EU. He saw it as a danger. He hated Maastricht. He hated everything to do with the EU. And the fact that there were so many people in Wales who were prepared to vote for Brexit indicates that there is still an element of a colonial mentality which exists. There is the servile Welshman, which is still there. And this is something which I put a bit of a rallying call at the end saying that, you know, we really need to get over this and move on.
Thank you so much. I think we need to end there. The book is, I think, on sale next week. And I would urge everybody who's listened to this podcast to go out and buy the book. It's a genuinely fascinating read. There's so much more that we haven't been able to discuss, even in this quite lengthy discussion. So thank you very much and best of luck with the book.
Thanks for listening to Golai, a Cardiff University podcast. Subscribe in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from to have the next episode download automatically.